Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, the speaker is Michael Paulette. He will be speaking on cultural Christendom, indigenous culture. So let's listen in on Michael Paulette.
The government sees these groups as some of the best ways in which they can maintain the kind of political stability that they want among the people, so that these Pentecostalist or fundamentalist sects are often used for very different purposes than just simply soul winning, which is what they say they're about. And it is this kind of fundamentalism which today, more than anything else, wants to put down and put away the indigenous cultures, and what that tries to do. Basically and very generally, if we talk about how does one destroy someone's culture, the way one goes about that is one tries to displace and then replace people's symbols and myths. Now, I'm not using the word myth here in a negative sense, but a much more technical sense, kind of that cultural anthropology sense, that every culture, every people has their myths, their mythos, their mythologies, which part of which is religious practice, but part of it is also familial organizations, social festivals, the structuring of a society, all of that. Well, what Christendom did at the time of the conquest, but what is happening now within fundamentalism as well, is still trying to replace the indigenous symbols and myths. And the way it does that is through giving these symbols and myths negative values. And we're all familiar with these negative values, but let me just toss out a few words so you get the sense of how one culture can put down, displace, and finally eradicate another culture. And again, the way you do this is not necessarily by using guns and swords or anything like that, but it's a much more political, pervasive kind of understanding. How do you give negative values to indigenous symbols and myths? Well, you label them as barbarism, or you call their practices savagery. Or, of course, one of the favorite ways of distinguishing is to talk about primitive symbols and practices and peoples over against what? If they are the primitives, then who are we? Civilized. And, of course, what better Christian thing to do in the world than what? Love of neighbor means to what? Transform primitive peoples and their cultures into civilized peoples and their culture. So basically what that means is to transfer these indigenous peoples into European, North American models. Right? I mean, in that sense one could say good intentions, but again, the devastation that comes with assigning things like primitive, civilized. Or again, here particularly, what is happening within fundamentalism and Pentecostalism is to label the practices, particularly the religious practices of indigenous peoples, as animism, sorcery, and finally, the worship of demons and Satan. And so this is one of the things that in some of the most radical fundamentalist sects right now, in Guatemala, they're more prevalent than in Nicaragua in terms of talking about those places. Within Guatemala, there is a resurgence, right, again, of the Mayan culture and Mayan religious practices and so on and so forth. to counter that resurgence of Mayan culture, the fundamentalists have mounted a whole new campaign against what they understand to be the practices of Satanism in the country. And what they are now labeling Satanism is simply Mayan religion, right? Indigenous people's practices is understood as Satanism, right? That it is of the devil, it is demonology. That's not the case. Certainly it's not Christianity. But again, to say, can you make that move to say, if it is not Christian, therefore, right, it is evil, it is demonic, it is the worship of Satan. Right? Again, that's assigning a tremendously negative value, which is not there in those religious practices. And so that becomes the way that one does that. And finally, right, what it means is to say that the indigenous peoples and their cultures need to be transformed because the way in which they live together and the kind of culture that they engage in is indecent and immoral, right? So that again, there is those claims again that these people practice indecency and immorality. Now again, why is it claimed to be indecent and immoral? Simply because it is not European value systems. Right? It's different, right? There's no mistaking that it is different, but does something being different automatically make it immoral? Right? That's the question I think we have to keep in mind, and we see kind of where the conflict and these kind of culture wars, if you will, are going on, is that right now it is the fundamentalists and the Pentecostalists in Central America in particular, but throughout Latin America, that are still saying any kind of indigenous peoples and their practices are indecent and immoral. And therefore, we need to transform them, we need to eradicate them, we need to get rid of them, all of those kinds of things. Now, how does this link up with social Darwinism? And again, right, you can imagine that a fundamentalist who would be told that they are advocating social Darwinism would just be aghast. But it's there in this sense, right? Remember, social Darwinism as promoted at the turn of the century by people like Alfred Russel Wallace and folks like that were the ones that advocated, not Darwin himself, as much as these folks, that advocated survival of the fittest. That's kind of the word in social Darwinism. Now what happens when that is put onto societies and cultures, this biological model of survival is upped to notions to say, well, if you were, right, physically fit enough to survive, that must also mean that you are intellectually, morally, and spiritually superior. And so therefore, right, since it is the European and the North Americans that colonized the entire world and everything within the world finally became adapted to their way of thinking, well, that must mean then that Christianity is what is spiritually superior, that Western law and its way of understanding and its mores is ethically and morally superior, and of course the white race and all that goes with it must be ethnically superior, and so on and so forth. So there's within this whole notion of the survival of the fittest, the whole ranking and distinction again of superior, inferior that goes with it. if you, you know, just for fun sometime, if you want to see how this works out in another area of the world and the consequences of it, read Cecil Rhodes, who too was a great social Darwinist, and it, this whole notion of survival of the fittest was his motto for taking over all of Southern Africa, and he wrote extensively about why that should be the case. Or within the United States, two of the greatest advocates of social Darwinism were John D. Rockefeller, and we kind of know where he went with things, and Teddy Roosevelt. And again, right, we kind of, the way Roosevelt thought the world should kind of kowtow to U.S. policies and so on and so forth. So this way of thinking, this social Darwinism, is deeply infiltrated within European and North American psyches and way of understanding. And the fundamentalists and Pentecostalists, again, in Central America, have no qualms whatsoever about preaching this kind of superior-inferior mentality and the superiority of Christianity, which makes everything else inferior. What are some of the results of this in terms of fundamentalism and what it preaches? First of all, this kind of fundamentalism and the things that go with it, even with respect to Christianity, is anachronistic. It tends to read things back into history. For example, they can read the New Testament, and from the New Testament, there's no doubt about it that what Jesus was all about was one who was affirming bourgeois, capitalistic, democratic values. Because after all, we know everyone back then was advocating bourgeois, capitalistic, democratic values, right? I mean, that's what first century Palestine was all about. It was just kind of like another state. It was the 51st state of the United States. I mean, their sense of historical consciousness and place and time and context totally escapes. It's totally unimportant. I mean, we know what's right. We know what the values are, and basically they are white, urban, industrialist, capitalist, bourgeois, democratic values. That's it. I mean, that's everything that the Bible advocates. I mean, that's after all too, right? Why we all know that the founding fathers of the United States were basically all good, God-fearing, fundamentalistic Christians, right? I mean, Pat Robertson will tell you that all the time. Historically, it's not true, but those are just picky little details which are unimportant, right? I mean, history is unimportant from this kind of fundamentalist, Pentecostalist mindset. Very anachronistic, so that you can just see kind of the steamroller way those values can be presented. Another thing about this fundamentalism is that it's otherworldly. The marker's giving up, right? It's otherworldly. So that what is first and foremost is the notion of saving souls. Everything else is unimportant. And here the notion of soul is not the kind of notion of soul that Jim has been talking about in his section and sessions. Here the notion of soul pushes that body-soul split, so that bodies, the material, what's going on in this world is totally unimportant. In fact, some would go so far to have a dualistic worldview, to say that everything in this world basically is evil, and that at the last judgment, God will come and destroy it all. So that their kind of theological understanding is that God in Christ is not at work to redeem creation, But basically, God at Christ is at work to pull our souls out of creation before God comes along and destroys all of it. Again, I don't think a very good interpretation of the scriptures. But that's their kind of presentation. They're totally otherworldly. And so, of course, then what is proclaimed is there is no way that one would want to, right, try to reintroduce and build up again one's indigenous culture and history and heritage, because that's all evil and bad and God's going to destroy that anyways. So forget all of that stuff. Leave all of that stuff behind. There's only one thing you need to worry about, and that's how are you going to save your soul? That's it. Everything else is to go to on the side. Part of being anachronistic, but I want to make the point again, is they are ahistorical, or kind of history-less. Right? History is not important. But what's important, to put it in kind of more political terms, is they have an ideology. They have certain ideologies, certain propositions, and these are immutable, absolute, unchanging. History doesn't make any difference. Here?
Does your
mind
affect
their absolute culture? Right. I mean, to be ahistorical is again a sense of being non-cultural, non-contextual.
Except for how long did that mean?
Right, that your own ideology would have some kind of culture, would have some kind of context, like I said, that it is a kind of sense of democratic, bourgeois, capitalistic, all of those things. They wouldn't acknowledge that at all. That's right.
So that when God comes to snatch things out of the culture, out of the wicked world, somehow this one is exempt.
That's right. That's right. Or the kind of things that obviously when the rapture comes, Jesse Helms will be taken, but Ted Kennedy will be left behind. Right. I mean you can make those kinds of political statements, because I mean you can just so neatly divide the world that way. Right. And again, you can see how their own culture, their own understanding of things. I mean that's the other thing, again, to say part of what they are is dualistic, right? And everything is clear-cut. Right? It's either this or that. There's nothing in between. There's no middle ground. There's no ambiguity. There's no gray area in anything. And so therefore, right, who needs indigenous culture? We know that that's all on the side of what's wrong, ignorant, primitive, evil, more all of those things, right? It's a clear cut, right? There's one side that is positive, the other side is negative, right? Again, it's that kind of, but like the old westerns, right? You cannot, right? The good guys wear white hats and the bad guys wear black hats. It's just that simple. That's all there's to it. Another thing that they are is hierarchical. They're hierarchical with regard to familial structures. And so again, a text like Ephesians chapter 5, right? The man, the husband, is the head of the family, under which is the wife, who is to be subservient and submissive to the husband, under whom are the children, and so on and so forth. Or, of course, and this is again one reason why U.S. government organizations like these groups and advocate these groups is they again push that kind of hierarchy that on top is the government and what the government says and elected leaders, officials, and everyone falls underneath it. So it's, again, going back to a previous session, this hierarchical model supports that notion of pyramid, and supports and legitimates notions of subjugation, exploitation, domination. Of course, who's here on the bottom? The poor folks, the indigenous folks, and so the indigenous folks and their culture is again always seen to be at the bottom. And therefore, even within their cultural understandings, that culture is to always be submissive, subjugated to the dominant culture, the dominant ethos, what lives and rules in other situations. That's the kind of setup. Those are the kinds of characteristics that, again, particularly now in Central America, are happening with these fundamentalistic and Pentecostal revivals. And at least from my perspective, right, one of the scariest things in Central America right now is the rise of these groups. And they are catching, there's more and more popularity with some of these groups. Again, because in one sense, they offer extremely simplistic solutions to complex problems. And so it's the kind of thing, when you combine this otherworldliness with this simple dualistic worldview and everything, it would say it can answer questions to poverty like, well, why are you poor? Well, the reason you're poor is that you don't believe in God enough. And so what you need to do is pray more, pray correctly, go to church more often, read the Bible, follow the Bible's rules for daily living, so on and so forth. And if you do this, then God will take care of you, and then your situation may change. And then they always add this little codicil. But even if it doesn't, it's okay, because God will save your soul. Right? And so we can all end up with singing a chorus of, I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home. Right? And keep that otherworldly focus going. And so all of the things within culture are unimportant.
I was just going to comment, though, that in Canada, it was the Anglican Church who set up residential schools and did all that. And so as the Anglican Church changed, was it once very fundamental?
Yes, once the Anglican Church and the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church and all the other churches were engaged in those same kinds of practices of taking over indigenous cultures. Not always holding to these particular principles, but in some senses always holding to the notion that to take it, you know, all the way back, even before North America, holding to that notion that European, that Eurocentric point of view is the universal point of view. So if you want to know what does it mean to be a human being, European models tell you. What does it mean to truly be moral? European models will tell you. What does it mean to truly be practicing the good life? European models will tell. I mean, right, that whole Eurocentric understanding, which is what colonialism was all about. The reason I'm talking about these groups is not because I'm trying to bash fundamentalism or whatnot, but if we look at what's happening in Central America in 1994, these are the groups that are practicing this kind of thing. Whereas other groups, the Anglicans, Lutherans, United Methodists, even the Catholic Church to most degree, is no longer engaged in putting down indigenous people's cultures, but in some ways is trying to help these people affirm their cultures, lift them up, retrieve them again, if possible. But in many cases, that's too late, you know. I can, if we have some more time, talk about
that. Can you make a distinction between the fundamentalists and the
It's very difficult to do that in Central America. I mean, those groups tend to blend together there. Whereas again, in the United States or Canada, not all Pentecostals are necessarily fundamentalists, nor are all fundamentalists Pentecostals. But that blends together in Latin America, that fundamentalism and Pentecostalism go hand in hand. I mean, for example, what in the U.S. right, would be called the Baptists, Southern Baptists, right? Southern Baptists are often fundamentalists, but now Pentecostalists. Down in Nicaragua, for example, the Baptist Seminary in Managua and other folks in Central America that call themselves quote-unquote Baptists would never fall into this line of fundamentalism, Pentecostalism. They're, I think one would say, conservative Christians, right? But they do not hold to this view, and they have worked out some kind of, if you will, conservative understanding of a liberation theology, and they are engaged in that. Phrases like preferential option for the poor, being on the side of the poor in solidarity with them, in accompaniment with them, are basic tenets of what Baptists are about in Central America. So, I mean, you know, again, in their culture and context, things divide up a bit differently than they do in a North American context.
Well, I wouldn't really call Billy Graham, for instance, a fundamentalist as opposed to Jerry Falwell.
Jerry Falwell?
Yeah, you know, that's the point there, isn't it?
Yes, but it is the kind of interesting thing that when the United States goes to war in the Persian Gulf, George Bush, practicing Episcopalian, doesn't bring in the Episcopalian priest or anything who have come out quite clearly against the war, but who has to come in and bless what the United States is going to do? Well, our religious legitimator of all U.S. imperialism, Billy Graham. Right? So, I mean, in that sense, Billy Graham does very much, I think, buy into a lot of this view. Maybe he's one of the nicer ones about that, and we like him, but when it comes to legitimizing this kind of ideology, and quite frankly, still legitimizing U.S. imperialism in the world, right, when the political leaders want the religious blessing, Billy Graham's the first person they go to. So, I would say, don't be deceived by that. Right.
Separating yourself from the Jewish. Just to comment on your, we have agreement, I know you're talking specifically about Central America, but much of Europe, you talk about European values, which over the last 500 years or 1,000 years have come closer together. Much of Europe, including many of our Scandinavian forebears, converted to Christianity and the threat of death.
At the time of the Reformation, Gustavus Adolphus the First converts to Lutheranism, expropriates all Roman Catholic monasteries, lands, and that, which is very convenient for the monarchy, and also says to anybody, you know, we are now all a Lutheran nation, right? All of you who, who dissent. I think he gave him a little time to leave, or else he'd be more than happy to kill him.
Just like Henry VIII.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And then after Henry married, he would try to convert everybody back and burn people to the stake if they didn't do it. And the whole struggle up to Elizabeth.
So, I mean, in that sense, right, it's not a new phenomenon, as Peter's point, certainly not a new phenomenon. I guess historically it's the tried and true way of going about converting different cultures. But, right, I mean, in my book, it's still going on today. We think we're nicer about it, or politer, or more civilized about it. Really, that's not the case. And today as well, I think, right, the new situation is that, thanks to part of what the church has been doing, right, in preaching to indigenous peoples and others, I think that one of the key theological themes that comes through in theologies of liberation and theologies of life is reasserting to peoples again that they have been created in the image of God. Right? I mean, pretty basic stuff, Genesis 1 and 2, image of God talk. But part of what historically has happened in taking away these people's cultures, history, dignity, also came with it the notion that, if you will, what does image of God mean, and who sets the standards for image of God? Again, European cultures, right? Europeans are created in the image of God, and all other nations and peoples were kind of, well, hangovers, leftovers, maybe kind of, sort of, but you really will be image of God when you're like us. But now what the popular church has been proclaiming is that what? Right? All people are created in the image of God, and that means truly, if you are in that image, right? If the Quiche, if the Rama, if the Quetzalcoatl are in the image of God, then they start thinking, well, if I'm in God's image, that must mean the things I do and who I am and our culture can't all be evil, can't all be bad, right? Can't all be just crap. I mean, that too must have something there as part of God's creation. And so you start to think about that, you start retrieving that again and saying, because this was who we were created to be in God's image. This is who we are. And so what comes here then again is the recognition that a Eurocentric point of view does not call the shots, cannot be seen as universal truth. Right? I mean, what Europeans think is human is what Europeans think is human, and not necessarily what the Mayan peoples of Guatemala think might be human, and what counts as moral, and what counts as the way of handling one, or how one owns property. Should everything be in terms of private property, or should it be much more understood as communally owned land? Or, as some would have it, no one owns the land, we just kind of rent it or borrow it from the earth. Now, I mean, who says John Locke and his view and philosophy of private property and all of that great European tradition is the way to understand land and property and set up governments and so on and so forth? I mean, all of those questions now come back up. And all of those things are things that need to be discussed and thought about within the political and social, cultural, and religious situations of Central America. And again, this isn't true for just Central. I mean, we can talk about this in South America. We can talk about this on the African continent. I mean, it's happening all over the world. I'm just trying to focus in on one little piece of the earth that I happen to visit occasionally and take some interest in and try to find out things about. But that's the dimension of what's happening there.
I'm you're stirring thoughts of the expansion in the psychological world in terms of the understanding of violence, and we talk a lot about boundaries, and a big part of that is we talk about mental abuse, emotional abuse. The overt abuse is very clear, physical, sexual, whatever, but that emotional abuse where someone tells someone else what's right to think or what they should think or presents a judgment, the psychological violence involved in that, I think is a good language, appropriate language to understand the cultural side, the culture side or the mental side, meaning killing those ideas or reshaping them without honoring the intrinsic beauty and value that's a very different, but the sense of violence at so many different levels is something that
Where's the
Yeah, I think, there's a sense of the line is you have debate, but that would be a furtive sort of vitalizing kind of exchange and even teaching. But
frustration, one of my frustrations is that the question of this mission isn't possible to be a mission church anymore.
Yeah.
And evangelizing church is this religion that's persuading people as with the Western folk having things, doing things, and they want to have them do them too, but there's no improvement to get them so far, and that is to westernize, to industrialize. So we shut down the incredible things. So often, it was from the control. And this, that happened here in the United States with the great black men lost in the
I think, Peter, that's a good point. Often the discussion is in terms of the difference between persuasion and coercion. And they look at that in terms of persuasion and coercion are issues of power. If you truly persuade, even let's say, right, that's a conversational model, to have a true conversation where one engages in persuasion, you understand the conversation partners to be equal. Right? You're as equal as I am in a conversation. We may have different points of view, right? It may even be the case, as usually it is, that I'm right and you're wrong. But we're still...
I remember one time when
we are still... Peter and I are... Well, we were good friends. I don't say that now. But there is still, I mean, because you can think, right, in people that you're truly in conversation, I mean, that is the part. Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong, but there's always that sense of equality.
Right.
Coercion is always some kind of situation, even in a conversation or whatever, where power is at work such that there's a situation of inequality. So that you, in some senses, you don't have a choice. That you want all these things, but what? It's either got to be this way or no way at all. I mean, again, to take kind of not too powerful a situation, right? But lectures are not conversations because there's any, right? The prof, right, has a sense of power that says, well, I've hopefully study this a little longer, know a little bit more about this. That doesn't mean there's not any feedback, but there is a sense of one person is seen as unequal among the rest of the conversation.
I give the grade.
That's right. Well, that's finally, that's the bottom line in terms of what gives a prop power. I give the grade. Right. So that's not, right? So in that sense, that's not necessarily, I mean, I think most of us would like to have our lectures be persuasive, but because we give grades, you know, there's certain boundaries that are drawn, and we draw them. I draw it when I'm the prof. Right. So that's the issue there, again, and so when it comes to questions of evangelization and cultures and all of that, I think the folks are saying, yes, it is still appropriate. We're willing to think about that, but over here, over again strike the history of missiology and its colonialism and all, which has always been on the side of coercion. That's where the transition has to come.
We have developed a situation in the United States and the West where victimization, claiming victimization, makes one incredibly powerful in a situation. Happened in the civil rights movement, happened in the feminist movement, it's happening in the gay and lesbian rights movement. And it's happening with white males who are suddenly claiming that they're victimized by things like affirmative action. If I can claim I'm a victim, suddenly I have power in the conversation that they have. I know this is moving in some sense a field from where I asked you to go, but when we start talking about doing violence emotionally, it seems it has to be part of the conversation at some point.
And that's right. That's interestingly enough, most of the leaders among indigenous peoples and else are not playing that victimization game yet. And part of that might be the context over there in terms of the sides against them, right, don't really care whether they're victims or not. They're going to keep doing what they're doing.
When they hire a PR firm in the United States to lock them,
right,
that's the tactic they take.
That's the tactic they take.
Yeah.
Right. But within the countries themselves, the indigenous peoples themselves are not playing the victimization game. But rather, they are concerned about how is it that we can empower ourselves so that we who have been voiceless for 500 years, or we whose voices have been taken away, now can bring our voices back to the conversation, can make ourselves be heard again. And I think at that point to say, what are they asking of us, asking of Europeans and North Americans in all of this? Obviously, all of this talk brings up, right, the whole buzzword again, which we know characterizes the postmodern world, pluralism. And that within Europe and North America, the proper ethic and response to pluralism is acceptance and tolerance. Okay. I think the peoples of Latin America are asking for more than that. And in some senses, if you will, demanding more than that. They are saying that we need to move beyond just simply toleration and acceptance of pluralism. Because mere acceptance can still be a power game and degenerate into that kind of paternalism that most of us, when it's done to us, detest. You know, oh yes, I'm sorry, I forgot to listen to you. Would you like to say something now? Right, but note again, right, who sets the terms, right? I still have the power when I say, oh, would you like to say something now? Right, that's not what, I mean, they want more than that in the sense of saying what needs to happen is that peoples in the first world, and again, particularly Europe and North America, need to listen to what they're saying. Right, and in other words, if they are going to listen, the prerequisite for being a good listener, right, and they're kind of polite about this and don't say that often, is silence. In other words, right, North Americans, just shut up. Right? Just listen to us for a change. Because maybe, just maybe, you'll learn something. Sure, that could be dangerous. So that could be very. But I mean, it is that kind of thing that this understand, right? Genuine, true listening is more than just simply tolerating or accepting someone's point of view. Right? Because again, a sense of listening means that yes, you truly are going to engage. you truly are going to take them seriously, it's back to this notion that there is a sense there to say there is equality there is respect there is dignity for who they are as a people and for their culture, and therefore there truly is something, right, that we can learn from them. And so when it maybe comes back again to the notion of mission and evangelization and all of that, right, maybe the question isn't, well, now what does that mean for us when we send our missionaries down there? I mean, maybe now the real question of mission and evangelization is, what does it mean for us when we have their missionaries come up here to us? Right, and start evangelizing and teaching us about who God is and what God does and how God is at work in our world today. Right. And then it might be the whole reversal of our usual understandings of mission. Right. It's now they will be sending the missionaries, if we want to use that term, to us, rather than us just kind of flowing down there all the time.
But maybe that can happen without them necessarily coming to us. I mean, right now we've got all the media and everything else. And we could very easily go down there and hear that.
A possibility, but I think sometimes that, at least with regard to the media, we have to recognize, I think, that most of the media still has things filtered through that dominant North American mindset that filters out many things, such that, right, what reaches us in the media about Central America, what people say, so on and so forth, might be far different than the understanding that people down there have of themselves and what's there. That I think sometimes we really do need that kind of face-to-face contact, right? I mean, just to pick up an example that kind of brings up a notion of culture, but within our own context, right? It's one thing to read books about what it is to grow up gay, lesbian in a heterosexual world and blah, blah, blah. It's another thing, right, to sit down face to face and talk to gay people, lesbians, about their life and who they are. And right, and until you meet a person and know them and experience who they, right, all of a sudden, right, it puts flesh and blood on all that stuff you've been reading. And to say, oh yeah, well, you know, sexuality isn't the be-all and end-all in their life, just like it isn't the be-all and end-all in my life. I mean, these are human beings. These are image of God people. But, you know, for some reason, what? It just doesn't sink in until you actually meet and talk with them. And I think sometimes in these situations, too, contact is important. It's not, I mean, certainly reading and that is better than nothing. But I think sometimes that contact is vital. Since there, I think, again, senses of accompaniment and solidarity are built through that face-to-face engagement with one another. Right. And again, often being confronted by somebody else about, you know, your biases, your prejudices, what you are doing to them, to put it in those kinds of terms, I may not even be aware of it. I mean, again, it's the sense that as I go down there every time, I'm just simply appalled at the policies, particularly of the United States, but of the developed world in general, and the devastation we have wreaked upon those peoples and those countries. It's just unbelievable how we are willing to ruin so much for our own gain. Right? And again, sometimes until you actually see that, live in it, confront it, You know, the distance of reading just keeps everything too nice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But to have to live it and to come up with I am responsible for some of this. You know, not that I wake up every morning and say, oh, well, let me see, how can I oppress and exploit somebody today? Right. But the mere fact of participating in North American culture, that's what I do. So that I can eat foods that I like to eat, even if they're out of season, and eat them at cheap prices, and cheap prices for clothes, and I mean, it goes on, and you know all of this. But it's the kind of thing, just living in this society means that we are devastating the people of Central America.
Do you think that, I think we talked about this before, the advent of all this free trade movement and so on, do you think ultimately investment in South America and so on is going to benefit, to some degree, raise the lifestyle of people, or create some kind of, is it going to help?
A few may benefit, but by and large, at least what is evident now, is that free trade is simply the latest form of exploitation that we've engaged in.
Do you think it's possible to create a real middle class in Central America, in the Central American countries?
Wow, what a question. That's hard. I mean, I really wouldn't even know how to. Certainly, free trade is not creating a middle class. That's apparent. Structural adjustment, right? One of the economic buzzwords now, is not creating a middle class. I think that for that kind of phenomenon to happen, there really has to be a sense where developed nations are really willing to withdraw from these people and kind of let them seek their own development. Right? And that does mean encouraging trade. I think part of the ways in which they can do that is to develop mixed economies and to become, which is again going counter to the stream right now, self-sufficient nations. Which free trade is in no way, shape, or form supporting. I mean, it's interesting that in these countries, one of the ways in which indigenous peoples assert their cultural identity, both out of necessity and as a means of resistance, is through participation in the informal or underground economy. Estimates are, for example, that in Nicaragua, over 60% of the economy is the informal economy. You know, now that can be barter, other kinds of trade or whatnot, but it's certainly not using the national currency and notions of free market and all of that. Why are they doing that? Well, one, it's the only way they can survive because they don't have any money, so somebody is saying, well, you know, I'll fix your shoes if you give me a bag of rice or whatever. So there's that. But secondly, it's also bartering and other ways of exchange were the ways in which those cultures functioned and lived. And so they're trying to bring those ways back again.
But isn't that also happening, I know in Canada there's the underground economy.
Sure.
I mean, we've got it too, and the government is saying, well, excuse me, but you know, we're missing out on taxes here.
Yeah, well, the estimates in Canada is the underground economy is probably about 15% of the gross domestic, national domestic product.
Yeah. Well, I think that's everywhere, that's in European countries and the United States, it's always been, and it's nothing new, I think it's always been, sort of focused in on it because of their deficits and things, but basically always been.
But again, right, in North America, for example, we might participate in the underground economy because that's the way in which you can avoid paying taxes. I know when this is in Canada, when the GST first came in, one of those 40 below days in Saskatoon, and the car didn't start, and I needed a jump, and you know, called sir, and it came out, and it was $15 cash or $17 check or credit card. Now, what's the difference? Well, $2 taxes is the difference. If I can just put it in my pocket, But again, within Central America, these underground or informal economies are not just ways of pay. I mean, they're all at the poverty level anyway. They don't pay taxes. These are ways of, again, resisting these outside kind of economic understandings and ways of exchange and reasserting once again their cultural identity, right? I mean, the Mayans didn't have this kind of currency system with money and checks and credit cards and all of that. So we're talking barter and exchange and other ways of understanding. But time's up. I think I know folks need to go, and Narnia, and we need to open it up for preparation for others. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We can continue the discussion again tomorrow.
Thank you. Okay, we'll get Emily. See you later, Mike.
We'll see ya.
So are you from South America yourself? Or
no, I'm from Michigan.
Oh, you're from Frankenmuth.
From Frankenmuth.
Oh, Frankenmuth, oh yes. Oh. So yes. Where you focused your interest, or you got attached to this whole thing in South America. What led you into that?
Well, I guess going through seminary and then graduate school, as I studied theology, one of the foci in theology now is liberation theology.
Oh, yeah.
So as I studied that and became interested in that, I thought, well,
wonderful.
You know, again, it's going on all over the world, and to say, at least within Lutheran tradition, because of involvement in countries like El Salvador or down in Brazil and Argentina, where there's a Lutheran contingency of that, to say, well, that's the area of the world that I'm going to focus on to try to find out more about.
Think, like just talking as Canadians, that, or even in the rest of the world, at some point the seeds that imperialism have sown are going to come back to haunt them, like in Canada now with all the land rights.
Oh, sure.
Brits have lost their empire. I mean, somewhere there's a price to be paid, and it will come back.
It rotates.
Oh yeah, we find that happening all over. I mean, we find it if you've been in Stephen Zunis's lectures on the Middle East, right? I mean, there again, the reason the Middle East was split up the way it was again the whole British divide and conquer colonialist policy. And now, right, all of that, and right, the billions of dollars we are pumping into this, I mean, if you will, we're paying for those imperialist moves of the late 1800s.
And South Africa's another.
South Africa's another. The whole continent of Africa.
You mentioned Cecil Rhodes.
Very good.
Right, and yet, right, there's Cecil Rhodes, but then, of course, right, we all think of him as such a grand fellow because you know, Rhodes Scholarships, right? I mean, everybody, a Rhodes Scholar, right? And that's a good, but I mean, in some senses, to be a Rhodes Scholar is...